I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Teenage murder plots, mythical powers, and French masquerades, they're all featured this week in our film critics' must-see picks. Today, they'll review the latest in indie, foreign, and documentary movies. But first, how do you live knowing your death is inevitable? We'll meet a filmmaker whose latest work explores that question. She explores how 9 different people came to terms with their mortality and how it changed their approach to living. We'll also learn about the Prairie Village surgeon she met who built his own casket at the end of a 12-year battle with cancer. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The film critics are in the house to kick the tires on the art and independent movies now showing in town. Among the films on our list today, Madam, about a dinner party organized by a wealthy American couple living in Paris that turns into a culture clash. Our critics today, film professor Cindy Haynes. Cindy, welcome back. Veteran film critic Steve Walker. Steve, nice to have
Hi,
you.
Hi, Steve.
And Bob Butler, whose movie reviews can be found at butlerscinemascene.com. Robert, how are
Good
you?
Good morning.
We're going to begin this morning with a documentary, Into the Night, Portraits of Life and Death, that premieres at 8 Monday evening on KCPT. It explores the various ways we think about death, and not death just in general, but our own in particular. The film features Prairie Village surgeon Dr. Jeff Peeler, who made his own coffin as he neared the end of his 12-year struggle with cancer. Our panel here has seen at least parts of this film, right, Bob?
I saw it. I watched it the other day. What makes it interesting is that almost everyone will find something that reflects their point of view, whether it's fear or conviction or what else, in the people that Helen has chosen for her movie. There's a guy who is defying death through cryogenics. He figures, hey, if you got the money, you can live forever. You just wait until a cure comes for your disease and then we'll thaw you out. But there's also a guy, ironically, the guy I identified with most, who is a former Islamic radical who turned his back on that. And philosophically, I find what he says about death and living with uncertainty to be really resonant. So you'll find something in here to cling to.
Joining us now is the writer and director of this documentary. That's Helen Whitney. Helen, good morning.
Good morning to you.
How did you pick the subjects that you featured in this film, including the Prairie Village surgeon, Dr. Jeff Peeler?
Well, I cast my net wide and asked everybody I knew, and I read everything in spiritual memoirs, talked to doctors and hospice workers, but I found Jeffrey through an op-ed that you probably all read in the New York Times about the experience of building a coffin. And I called him immediately, and I gather there was a tsunami of phone calls to him. Everybody read it and wanted to talk to him. And I was very lucky because he knew my work and had seen some of my films and said, basically, come on out, let's do something together.
Wow. Sharon Stone is the narrator of this film. How did you arrange for her to take that role?
I heard her voice. I mean, I wrote all the narration, but I was looking for a certain kind of voice, sort of husky, rich, like a cello, and not artificial, not actressy, and she has narrated documentaries before in a very intimate way, and I felt that was the voice I wanted. I wanted as if you were overhearing someone talking to themselves. So I had my agent call hers, and she loved the narration and agreed to do it.
Helen, Cindy Haynes wants to ask you a question.
You say this film is dedicated to the life and work of Ted Winterburn. Who is Ted Winterburn?
He's my beloved friend and collaborator and editor, and he died. Oh, the irony of it, making a film about acknowledging mortality. This man died in the middle of this film. And if anything speaks to the importance of this film, which is really talking about this, bringing it out of the closet, it was our relationship, because even the two of us who had worked together for 30-odd years and have known each other, we found it difficult to talk about this while he was dying and reviewing footage about mortality. Mm. And finally we did. And so that's who it's in. It's a long answer to your question. He's an extraordinary human being and a great, if not legendary, editor.
Helen, is this right? At least 5% of the U.S. population will have a near-death experience at some point in their lives?
That's what Mr. Gallup said, and he conducted the poll because he, too, had a near-death experience.
Wow.
And in truth, you know, if you look through the, you know, the history of religion, there's all kinds of examples, in not just in Christian history, way before, visions and of people being transformed by them. So it's much more common than we know about, and a lot of people find it very difficult to talk about, and so we're not even recording them. It's probably a much higher figure.
That's Helen Whitney. She's the writer and director of Into the Night, Portraits of Life and Death. It premieres at 8 o'clock Monday evening on Kansas City Public Television. Helen, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts about this?
Yeah. No, but I thought it was interesting that I've done a story for KCUR's website on Dr. Peeler, so I knew that story.
Yeah, we had him on the show here.
The mortician. Who opens the film, she's kind of goth-looking. She couldn't look any more like a mortician. She was interesting. I'm glad she had an atheist in there to talk about, let's not make death always about heaven. So I thought it was a nice cross-section. It was a little all over the place, but...
Hmm. Okay.
I enjoyed it. I found it very moving in parts, but I agree.
Yeah.
It is all over the place.
Okay. Let's turn to some films that are opening up this week, art, independent, foreign films. And Steve Walker, let's turn to the film Madam. It's about a dinner party organized by a wealthy American couple living in Paris. It turns into a culture clash.
Well, yes, it does. And here's why. Toni Collette and Harvey Keitel are the married couple. He's many years older than her, I think 30. But anyway, they're very rich and well-to-do, and they have a lot of servants, and they're having this dinner party with various important people coming, and Toni realizes to her horror that there's an extra plate, and she doesn't have a 14th guest, so she convinces her maid, who is from Spain and played by Pedro Almodovar's muse, Rosie De Palma. You'll know her face. I mean, if you've seen any Almodovar movie, you know her. To pose as someone, one of her friends, and pose as someone important as the 14th guest.
Mm-hmm.
And to Toni Collette's horror, their art consultant kind of falls for her. He thinks she's great. And, as Toni says, Toni Collette's character is a horrible racist, narcissist. I could go on, but says to her at one point, "This is not your world, so don't think you're going to succeed in this." And I think it's their decision to invite her to the table was culturally tone deaf. But what happened is opens up an interesting conversation about class.
It's kind of a Cinderella story for the aughts. It brings the whole idea up to date. The scullery maid gets a crack at joining the nobility, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Rosie De Palma is terrific in this. She's one of the most unconventional looking women on earth.
That's a nice way of putting it.
And yet she's compelling. I enjoyed her more than the rest of the film, to be honest with you. I thought a lot of the dialogue was forced, but I could sit around and watch her a lot.
I think there's a reason Harvey Keitel isn't in a lot of comedies.
Oh, right. Did you feel like he was delivering?
It was very, very awkward, I thought. But Rosie De Palma is absolutely fascinating to watch and did a terrific job in this film. She was perfectly cast.
And I appreciate that Toni Collette plays as someone who's so incredibly unlikable.
Yeah.
Actors don't do that a lot sometimes.
So you all like this
film, liked it. Yeah,
Madam.
I did.
With reservations. Yeah, reservations.
Okay, the film again was Madam. Three thumbs up here for that one. Let's turn to Oh, Lucy, Bob. It's about a lonely woman living in Tokyo who falls in love with her English teacher and follows him to Southern California.
Yeah, this is an oddball movie. It's from the director Atsuko Hirayanagi, and it stars Shinobu I'm going to be having a hard time with this one, Terjima, who is a very fine actress. Here she plays an office drone, a single woman hitting her 40s, The one man she loved was stolen by her sister. When the film opens, she's standing on a subway track where yet another Japanese businessman flings himself in front of the train. Apparently, this is a daily occurrence. Her niece says, I ran out of money. I signed up for these English lessons. Will you pay for them and take them for me? You know, so she goes to this English lesson and meets Josh Hartnett, who is her instructor. We've got a clip here of Josh's method, which to say the least is kind of bizarre. He says she has to have an American name, Lucy. He puts her in a blonde wig, and he says, if you're going to speak American, you've got to hug people all the time.
This is from Oh Lucy.
Okay, now we're going to start with something very basic but essential. We're going to introduce ourselves to each other. I'll say, hi, my name is John. And then you say,
hi, my name is Setsuko.
No. Bye-bye, Setsuko. Hello, Lucy. Lucy.
Hi, my name is Lucy.
That's very good. Very good, except it's not quite right. Because you see, Lucy is a very relaxed girl. So Lucy says, hi, my name is Lucy. How are you?
Hi.
Open your mouth a little bit more. Let out more sound. Hi.
Hi.
Okay.
That scene is very funny.
Yeah.
I felt rather uncomfortable when that scene came on, and I thought it was going to go somewhere bad. But it didn't. It was just very, very strange.
Well, I wouldn't say it goes bad necessarily, but this lonely woman falls for her instructor only to discover that her niece has run off with him to America. And so, with the sister who betrayed her decades before, they go to Los Angeles in search of the missing niece. And I wouldn't say she finds fulfillment there, but it becomes a fish out of water comedy.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
There's several things going on here. Anyway, it ends on that same subway platform where it began, but happily not with a suicide.
Hmm. And there's something going on with this film and the filmmaker in that Will Ferrell, executive produced this movie, on their flight to L.A., her and her sister, Megan Mullally is in the middle seat. And so there's some connection to L.A. comics and the comic improv scene, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I do like this lead actress. I thought she was really compelling and quietly so. This was not a hysterical performance by any stretch. Is it, you know, Lives of Quiet Desperation?
So do you guys recommend this film?
Yeah,
I do.
For an unusual experience.
It's very strange.
It's fun.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
It's fun, unusual.
But it's well done. Yeah.
Okay, the film again, Oh Lucy. It's playing at where?
The Tivoli
right now. Okay. Let's move on again as we review the latest art, independent, and foreign film showing in Kansas City this weekend. Bob Butler, I Kill Giants. It's about a young girl creating the world of monsters and magic in order to escape her troubled life.
Yeah, well, this is the first of two movies we're going to review today that are based on graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the first of two movies today in which I feel the visuals far surpass the content of the narrative itself. What we've got here is a teenager. Her name is Barbara. She's played by Madison Wolfe, whom I really kind of liked, but she's definitely out there. She wears a pair of rabbit ears, which reminded me of Donnie Darko.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, any girl that would wear rabbit ears to high school is definitely asking, you know, for a smackdown. She spends her days roaming the coast. Apparently, this is set in New England, although it was shot in Belgium and Ireland. Roaming these almost primordial forests, searching for giants. She believes that giants live in the woods and will come to do damage to humans, and she's there to protect them. The film was made by a guy named Anders Walter, and the plot is one of those get-you-in-the-last-act revelations that requires that you don't ask logical questions for three-quarters of the film. For instance, our heroine lives in a house with an older sister who may be about 20 and is working to support the family and two video game-addicted brothers, but where are the parents? Well, if they answer that right off the bat, there's no movie. So it's one of these things where they, you know, by denying us basic information, And frankly, that hacks me off. It irritates me. I find that very, very, I mean, maybe you can get away with that in The Sixth Sense, but this is not The Sixth Sense. Nevertheless, the visuals in this are unbelievable.
The special effects make the movie, and they are so well done.
The budget was what? It was not that very... Yeah.
Well, just the shots of the seashore and their house on a sand dune. Although, let's face it, if this family is financially strapped, they're sitting on a $2 million lot. But anyway...
Right. And if you know Sondheim's musical Into the Woods, there are some... overlaps as far as themes with the fairy tale kind of mentality going on here and the darkness in the woods, and whatever that is for you.
There's an attempt to balance her fantasy against reality. Zoe Saldana plays a school psychologist who's trying to help her out. There again, their conversations have to be very carefully poised lest they give away secrets that they want to reveal plot-wise late in the movie.
We have a clip here from I Kill Giants.
This is our heroine, Barbara, talking about her methodology.
We're going to get in trouble. We're going to save this town. It should have taken the second bait. Something else must have grabbed his attention. There is no way this wouldn't work.
We have to go back. We'll say we got locked out by accident.
Hold on. You need to understand what we're dealing with. Giants aren't real. Then why are you sweating?
My goodness. From I Kill Giants. So Bob, you...
I'm a visual yes, a narrative no. How's that sound?
That sounds good to me.
Okay.
Like the film, it's the Screenland.
Okay.
You like the Screenland armor, mm-hmm. that one.
But you liked it, Cindy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Let's move on to a film. One more before a break here. Let's go to Flower, Cindy Haynes. It's a film about a sexually aggressive, damaged teenager who attempts to address bullying and sexual assault.
Well, there seems to be a new genre. Well, maybe it's not that new. About disturbed teens and matters of bullying and it's
their sexuality is kind of hyper.
Is exactly. It's just right up front. It's a companion piece to Thoroughbreds, which we're going to make reference to shortly. But I did not. It's a cross between a horror film and a coming of age film, and it just didn't work for me.
Mm, okay. Anybody else?
I just want to say one thing. This girl calls herself a feminist, proto-feminist. She has been, let's say, offering sexual favors to cops all over town and then blackmailing them to pay her so she can save the money to bail her dad out of jail. There's that story. And then her mom is played by one of the funniest comic actresses out there, Catherine Hahn. But the movie just left kind of a sour feeling to it. It's tawdry, and it gets into an allegation of sexual assault of her new stepbrother from this man they meet at a bowling alley. I don't know. I don't understand why this is interesting to anyone.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Steve.
We have a clip here from Flower, Cindy.
Yes, it's Erica having an argument with her mother.
Let's listen to this clip from Flower.
I know that this has been a really, really, really difficult transition for you. And I know it's not easy. I really appreciate everything that you have been doing, you sweet, sweet girl. I need you to say one thing, one nice thing to Luke.
To Luke?
For me. Please, it will go so far.
Will you give me hair tickles?
Will you say something nice?
Mm-hmm.
Practice with me? Can we come up with one nice thing you can say to that human being?
Yeah. I'll tell him that if his plane crashes into a mountain, he'll be able to keep a whole lot of starving passengers.
Stop it.
Ow.
Erica, please. It would just make my life so much easier.
He looks like he should smell crazy bad.
Still not helping.
But he doesn't. And he has nice eyes.
If you want to see a good movie about a teenage sexuality blooming in a young woman. See Find 13 with Evan Rachel Wood and Holly Hunter.
Find 13?
Just 13.
The 13.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure. Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll continue rolling through some good art, independent, and foreign films showing in Kansas City with Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Coming up after a break, The Death of Stalin. And here's a little preview. Our critics loved it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Okay, we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we discussed the changing nature of social media and how people use it, especially in light of the recent Facebook data leak debacle. You can hear that at kcur.org/uptodate. And and until you finally decide to pull the plug for good, follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday, we'll sit down with the leader of the Kansas Department of Children and Families to discuss the state's troubled foster care systems. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour, we're visiting with our film critics. They are Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. We're running through the new film showing around town. Let's go to one that all three of you, I think, are high on. It's The Death of Stalin, Steve Walker. It's a comedy about the final days of the Soviet dictator and the chaos that ensued following his death.
That's a good description. This film is based on a graphic novel, which is interesting. And at the helm is Armando Iannucci, who, if you watch Veep on HBO, you know he is a brilliant satirist when it comes to politics. And this movie is just as funny as any random episode of Veep, which I find hilarious. It's set in Moscow in 1953. It opens with this funny scene where there's this orchestra performance, and Stalin calls the radio Moscow and says, "Did you record it for me?" And he went, "No." And so they have to pull all the musicians and get homeless people off the street to fill up the audience so they can, clapping sounds right.
There's one line that is so brilliant because it sums up the paranoia of the Stalinist era. Paddy Considine, who plays the head of Radio Moscow, won't let the audience leave because he knows they have to do the concert over and record it. And he says, "Don't worry, no one's going to die."
Well, in short order, we meet Stalin's posse. I don't know, maybe.
Well, they're like a bunch of frat boys, but they're in charge of this gigantic country.
Right. And they're profane, as all get out. And Steve Buscemi plays Khrushchev, which is kind of an interesting bit of casting.
Yes, it is.
So they
be a skinny
uncover
Khrushchev.
Stalin laying in a pool of urine. Which is also oddly, macabrely funny because nobody wants to touch him to move the body.
Well, in fact, he's still breathing.
So you're right, he eventually does succumb, and then it's like political backstabbing and jockeying for position with a lot of high stakes because all of these people want to be the successor.
I love the moment when they're arguing, all these bigwigs, about whether they should call in a doctor to treat Stalin. And one says, "All the best doctors were in the gulag or dead."
So they're stuck. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it goes through the funeral and his children, Stalin's children, Svetlana and Vasily, come home and they're a mess. And you just can't predict where it's going, and it's really very well written.
It's a Marx Brothers slamming door farce about communism and this momentous moment in history. The story about re-recording the concert, that actually happened, but it was a couple of years earlier.
Oh, really?
Stalin said, "I want a recording of that," and they freaked out and said, "Oh, my God, get everybody back here."
Right.
That film, it's The Death of Stalin. We got a clip here, Steve.
We do, and it gives you an indication. The funeral is about to happen, and the first voice I hear, I think, is Buscemi as Khrushchev. And it's just them bickering like a bunch of fishwives about whether bishops were invited and who sits where and who's more important. You'll get a sense of it.
This is from The Death of Stalin.
Did you invite them?
No.
Ask Beria if he invited the bishops.
Don't give me orders. Ask Beria if he invited the bishops.
Did you invite the bishops?
Yes.
Yes. Well?
He said yes.
I'm going to give everyone in Red Square a voucher permitting one kick each to a stupid face.
Is he asking for some delicious hay?
No, he said something quite complicated about a voucher system.
Ask Nikita why in God's ass he invited the bishops.
No, I've already explained
why. Nikita!
You tell him. Never mind. Swap.
No.
Just swap with me.
I said no.
We can make it look like it's part of the ceremony.
Steve, do you think an audience of a certain age would appreciate it more than?
I have so little connection to people of other ages than my own. I couldn't tell you. I don't know. I mean,
Bob, what do you think?
Well, you know, it's so entertaining on the surface that you don't have to know the backstory, the history to really appreciate
it. No, I didn't know any of these players except Khrushchev. But
on the other hand, the fact that Khrushchev, who pounded his shoe on the UN podium and screamed he was going to bury us, is the good guy in this, will throw a few people for a loop.
Hmm. And I do want to recommend In the Loop, another film that he made that is fantastic political satire.
That was Bush-era idiocy.
But bottom line, you all were very high on
very
Seth
high on
Stalin.
Terrific. I laughed out loud a lot, and I don't often in the film.
Do
so
that.
Okay.
At the Tivoli in Glenwood.
The Death of Stalin, 3 thumbs up. That's pretty high praise. Okay, Cindy Haynes, we're moving on to Thoroughbreds. 2 wealthy, unstable teenage girls plot the murder of a creepy stepfather.
This is the same genre as we talked about a little earlier. We're talking about kids who are sexually abused and bullied and how they deal with it, plotting a murder. I mean, it just, it's very disturbing to think that these films, which are well done and with good actors, are aimed at a young audience that's impressionable. And it's not The Breakfast Club, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. So, I didn't appreciate the film. I found it very violent, very disturbing, and it's currently at Liberty Hall, as a matter of fact.
We have a clip here from Thoroughbreds, even though you're not recommending it very enthusiastically.
No. Amanda and Lily, the two main characters in the film, are planning a murder.
Okay, this is from Thoroughbreds.
You ever think about just killing him?
I mean, no.
Could at least consider it.
No.
Just weigh the pros and cons.
No.
Why don't you consider all options?
Yeah, not like murder.
Yeah, sure, it's outside the box, but you can only get so far thinking how everyone else thinks. Look at Steve Jobs.
What?
I'm just going off what you're giving me. It's a cost-benefit analysis. Seems like you could generate a lot of benefit for a lot of people.
Except I'd spend the rest of my life in jail.
Why are you assuming you get caught?
Again, that's from Thoroughbreds, and Cindy Haynes says, right?
I'd like to mention that Anton Yeltsin is in the film. It's one of his last performances. He was killed in an accident, and he does a very good job as a small-time drug dealer who was employed to commit this murder.
Okay, again, the film Thoroughbreds. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're running through the latest art, independent, and foreign films showing in Kansas City right now with Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, and Bob Butler. Okay, we're going to November, Bob. It's about a film that details weird spirits inhabiting a 19th century Estonian village.
Good luck with this, Bob.
Okay, first, let me say that this is visually one of the most spectacular things I have ever seen.
Wow.
And
wow.
Narratively, one of the most deadening. Okay.
Okay.
The film is from Estonia, not known as a filmmaking center, but...
Or the land of happiness.
Apparently not. This film was made by director Rainer Sarnet. He also wrote it, adapting the best-selling novel in Estonia of the last 20 years. November is set in a village, it looks like the early 19th century. Peasants, dirty faces, scraggly hair and beards, deep shadows, hovels. The novel was not so much a through story as a collection of stories all taking place in this little town in November. This poses a problem for our writer-director because there is no one plot taking him through. This is a movie that has a few spectacularly effective moments. I found that after a while I was starting to numb, because when you're dealing with folklore, you lack the psychological realism that draws me into characters and makes me care. The plots. Well, there is a peasant girl who loves a peasant boy, but he's attracted to the daughter of the local baron. Did I mention that the peasant girl can turn herself into a wolf at night? Well, that's just par for the course in this town, because the peasants have creatures called krats. They are created of pieces of wood and
sometimes animal skulls,
and garden instruments, garden tools,
which are very clever,
and they're animated, and they move, and they do their bidding, and they're to do this, they all have to sell their soul to the devil, but that's okay. The krats are doing their bidding, and some of this stuff, you sit there with your jaw opening, going, "This is gorgeous." There's a scene that's sort of like the Mexican Day of the Dead. All the villagers gather in a graveyard on a certain night. And their dead relatives, dressed in white, come walking through the woods. And it's jaw-dropping. It is so beautiful, so evocative. And yet, once you get past that surface, there's not a lot of meat here.
I think this is a case where you have to be Estonian to really appreciate it. I do. I think
that's a very limited niche audience in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Well, my mom was from Latvia.
Right.
A neighbor.
Steve?
I'm just with Bob. I mean, I think I was stunned by some of the cinematography, which is in black and white, by the way. And so any new black and white film I can see is a plus.
Mm-hmm.
Those creatures, the krats, were very clever. The faces of the peasants like, oh my God, where did he find these people?
Yes. You know, I was thinking of Kurosawa films. Straight.
And Fellini used to find very unique looking people too. The clothes that the peasants wear, someone like Marc Jacobs could do a whole fall fashion line based on these torn up pelts. And so there's a lot to take in, a lot to look at. But I often said, what the hell am I looking at? What am I watching?
And it wasn't real clear.
Yes and no. I'm thinking
it was clear, but it wasn't compelling. I was never emotionally invested in any of this.
Visually, I was hooked, obviously. Yeah. It's magnetic. Right. Now,
maybe this is a good time to sort of pause and think about the time of year we're in right now and the films that we're looking at here today. A lot of hit and miss going on today. Is that reflective of the time of year? You always hear this tale that the maybe not the greatest films are released in February, March, April.
Well, I think we were very surprised that we had this many films.
We were very surprised.
It's post-Oscar unloading time.
Yes, right.
Is that what this is, Bob?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes and no. I think there's some really good films that are included in
but they're films that the distributors know these are little films. They cannot compete with, you know, the big titles.
Right.
And once the Oscar thing is over, it's time to get them all out there.
I also think there's another player in this game, and that's Screenland.
Yes.
Is bringing a lot of what you would call cult films. Mm-hmm. Like November,
Giants.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
that are different, that are generally not seen in your AMC.
Definitely not.
Steve was pointing out that we're getting movies that are opening the same day as New York.
Very often lately, mostly at Screenland, but Jerry and Brian at the Tivoli and Fine Arts, respectively, do their best to stay on top of things.
Because you can open the New York Times on Sunday and look at the ads, and you're going, Seen that.
We can, because we often get links to, and there's still great foreign films to come in the next month.
Huh. Okay. So that film,
November.
November. Okay. And we're going to move on here now to a different one. It's called The Party, Steve Walker. It's a dinner party drama.
It's a dinner party from Hades to me.
Mm-hmm.
Writer-director Sally Potter, who's done some interesting things, has assembled a terrific cast. Also shot in black and white, by the way.
Yes, interesting.
Kristen Scott Thomas, Timothy Spall, Patricia Clarkson, Cherry Jones, Emily Mortimer, Cillian Murphy. These are all esteemed actors who are usually fun to watch. When they have something to say that's not as pretentious as this line I wrote down, I believe what you're experiencing is a feeling.
Yikes.
I went, really?
Yeah, that's what you got?
Yeah, yikes. I said that too.
Okay. Gonna have to go to the mat. This is a... How shall I even begin this? The movie only runs for 70 minutes, 70 minutes of real time. It's almost like a one-act play.
Mm-hmm.
They're slamming doors in this one, too. People coming in and out. It's got political commentary. It's talking about the British healthcare system. There's someone who reveals they have a disease. There's illicit relationships going on. Is it heavy? Is it, you know, substantial? No, I just enjoyed the catty dialogue, especially that given Patricia Clarkson, who can do no wrong in my book.
Usually, for me too. Yeah,
yeah. I'm surprised this was made into a film. It really is a stage production.
It's bad Albie is what it is. It reminded me of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, only done by four-year-olds.
But just 70 minutes, that's hardly...
It's barely a feature-length
film.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But you know what? If it had been any longer, it probably wouldn't have been able to support that.
Right.
I might be... If it had been 90 minutes or 2 hours, I'd be in Steve's camp.
We're going to hear a clip of Patricia Clarkson and Cherry Jones kind of going back and forth as the guest of this so-called party.
This is from the 70-minute-long film titled The Party.
Oh, Gottfried. You're an embarrassment.
Possibly. But at least he's trying to help.
Oh, you're defending Gottfried now?
April, I too am frequently described by internet trolls as an embarrassment or worse. Or much worse, actually. Is it a crime to be an embarrassment?
Martha, you're a first-class lesbian and a second-rate thinker. Must be all those women's studies.
April, really? I am a professor specializing in domestic labor gender differentiation in American utopianism.
My point exactly.
Yeah.
Made you laugh.
I love Cherry Jones, too. For never seeing her on stage, you will never forget
but you're,
her.
Steve, you're saying no, Bob.
I'm
no. Saying
so
yes.
I'm saying yes. I'm not saying it's great, but I'm saying I enjoyed it.
Okay, that film, again, was titled The Party. Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about the new artsy films showing around town.
Artsy.
Let's go to, that's a word for them. Cindy, let's go to the film Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story that you guys have also been very big on with your 3-to-see picks every week. This has been on the list the last couple of weeks.
Well, of all the movies we've talked about, this is the one I most highly recommend.
Interesting.
I thoroughly enjoyed the Hollywood history. A story of a very bright woman who was derailed by her beauty.
I've had that
fascinating.
Yeah.
She helped invent a secure torpedo guidance system. She said she wanted to do something to help the war effort. And that technology is now the basis for secure Bluetooth, GPS, and Wi-Fi, and it's known as frequency hopping. She worked on the system with a friend of hers who was a composer. And they actually received a patent for this invention. She was also known as the most beautiful woman in the world, and it was her blessing and it was her curse.
How is it her curse?
Well, she wound up being married 5 or 6 times, and that's an indication there that men were fascinated with, you know, the
package, but not necessarily the contents.
Exactly. And in fact, she was a very brilliant woman.
And she was addicted to plastic surgery, which in the 60s wasn't very good.
And it really destroyed her. She became a recluse as a result.
Right.
I mean, if she had a mirror in the house and looked at herself, she would see how horrific she looked, and she didn't go outside.
Interestingly, the whole part about the invention was the least interesting part to me.
Right.
I was more interested in her family's immigration as Jews from Poland, I believe.
Austria.
Mm-hmm. How she got started in the business, how she would make a hit and then make a flop and make a hit and make a flop, and Hollywood didn't know what to do with her.
Talk about an independent woman. At 16, she's posing for nude photographs. At 19, she stars in Ecstasy, a notorious film in which she swims naked and has what may have been the movie's first on-screen orgasm. Fake, but nevertheless, you know, for dramatic purposes.
She was also in Samson and Delilah, Boomtown with Clark Gable, Algiers with Charles
Boyd. But she doesn't rank
Boyd.
Among our greatest
actresses, in fact, she was a barely adequate actress, a great right. beauty who barely could act but had a great mind that no one knew about.
Well,
she made a film called White Cargo, if that's any indication of the quality of films she was in.
White Cargo, okay.
This documentary was executive produced by Susan Sarandon. This is another example of you want to get it done, you want to tell the stories, do it yourself. And Sarandon put her reputation and her money behind it.
The life of Hedy Lamarr. What's the clip we have here, Cindy?
A variety of people talking about Hedy.
Okay.
Inventing was her hobby. She not only had a complete inventing table set up in her house, but Howard Hughes gave her a small version of the set of equipment, which she had in the trailer where she stayed in between takes in her motion pictures.
When Hedy first met Howard Hughes, he was dating every Hollywood star, and she did date him.
Howard Hughes, of course, was a great airplane designer. So probably they had a compatible spirit with one another.
It was definitely cerebral because she said he was the worst lover she ever had.
Okay. No, it's a good movie. It really is entertaining.
And it's at the Tivoli.
That film, again, Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story. Okay, just have a few films left as we run through the best art and independent films showing in town. Yeah. Let's go to a film, A Fantastic Woman, Steve Walker.
It's yes.
A transgender woman's life is filled with grief following the death of her older boyfriend.
And following the death of her older boyfriend, whose family is still around and makes every effort to keep her away from anything to do with his funeral, with any wake.
With his life.
With
in
his
general.
Life.
Yeah.
His wife gets involved, his children, adult children. This won the Oscar a couple weeks ago for Best Foreign Film. And
deserves it.
Deservedly. It's in Spanish. Daniela Vega was the first trans woman to have ever presented at the Oscars, which she did a
right.
couple weeks ago. It's a great performance. And she submits to some scenes that are hard to watch because it's about how the police department, for example, deals with her as a trans woman.
This was written for her. And watching this, I was struck. I don't feel like I'm watching acting. I feel like I'm
right.
watching a person revealing their true self.
Mm.
And that was the kind of revelation that just sort of gobsmacks you. You're not used to that. We're so used to this veil of artifice. This wasn't acting. This was being. And you really got the sense of this individual's soul and the pain she's going through.
Which is perpetrated every other day by the people who won't use the pronouns that she prefers. The police humiliate her by making her strip to do a questioning, which is completely unnecessary and abusive.
But and they're implying that she might be complicit in his death.
Yes, right. She's not believed on that story either.
But what I love about this is that in the end, it isn't just an, poor me, I'm being abused story.
No.
You get the sense that there is a triumphant spirit in this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And
she will survive.
It's going to come. It's going to persevere and come through.
Is that song in it, in fact? It's been a while since I've seen
it. I Will Survive.
I Will Survive. It should be. No, it's very highly recommend it. It's a beautiful film, and it's playing at the Fine Arts and the Alamo downtown.
A Fantastic Woman, again, it won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film,
yep.
right?
Yeah.
Okay. Before I lose it, we just have a little time left. What are your three to see, your picks for the three best films showing on area screens right now? Steve Walker,
mine are Madam, which is at the AMC in Independence, only one screen there.
Wow.
The Death of Stalin and Fantastic Woman.
Okay.
A Fantastic Woman, Death of Stalin, and Bombshell.
Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fantastic Woman, Death of Stalin, and just to be contrary, The Party.
Okay.
So there.
Okay, some coming attractions, some things that are sort of on the horizon. Cindy, what would you point to films that are will be released here in the next few months?
Steve's going to mention a film, Uncommon Allies, that's going to be included in the Kansas City Film Fest.
KC Film Fest opens on the 12th of April. And Steve, many people who've been in the studio are in this film. It's a documentary about Rosalind Temple, who I understand you've had on the show.
Absolutely.
Susan Wilson is in the show, in the film, Sly James. Rosalind Temple is a woman who lost her son to a homicide. She's African-American.
An incredible woman.
Incredible woman. Yeah. And it's really a portrait of her and how the police have utilized her, is the best word, to help them with neighborhood relations.
Yes.
It's very warm and it's very inspiring. So I highly recommend that. KC Film Fest, opening night, April 12th, 7 p.m. Thursday at the Cinemark on the Plaza, I think.
Is there one film you'd recommend, Cindy, that's coming up that you are excited about?
In the Fade and Loveless, both films nominated for Oscars for Best Foreign Language Film.
Okay. We'll have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Steve Walker, Cindy Haynes, Bob Butler for coming in today. Look at Bob's reviews at butlercinemascene.com. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Yesterday on the show, how data mining and privacy leaks have changed our relationships with social media. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On Monday's broadcast, learn simple ways to break very bad habits. Also, we'll meet the head of the Kansas Department of Children and Families, whose foster care policies have been under heavy fire. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.